The city of Pokrovsk in Ukraine is now completely in Russian hands, and the sister city of Mirnograd is now completely surrounded, and still 2,000 Ukrainian troops are completely cut off and with no hope of escape, and effectively they have ceased to be a factor in this war. This continues on with a number of advances on the front line in the Russia-Ukraine war, and all of this is in the process as Steve Witkoff lands in Moscow to see if there can be any way to find a negotiated settlement between Ukraine, Europe, the U.S., and Russia to bring this war to an end, and to try to make sense of a lot of very contradictory information flowing out just from today. We have back with us one of our favorite guests, Colonel Doug McGregor, defense and foreign policy analyst and former advisor to the Secretary of Defense, and of course, friend of the show and highly decorated combat veteran. Doug, as always, delighted to have you here.
Good. Thanks, Dan.
Well, look, let's just start off with the first. Now, this issue with Pokrovsk, it effectively fell about a week or so ago, but the Russia today, and there you see some of the video here, there's actually a lot of video where they have guys literally just walking around the streets, you know, not even concerned about what may happen with any Ukrainian snipers or any Ukrainian FPV drones, etc. So it seems pretty legit that they actually have the city. What do you say?
Well, of course. I mean, you had not just Pokrovsk, but a number of other related and battles of encirclement that have gradually closed and ended because the Ukrainians have either surrendered in great numbers or they're dead. Some escaped, but very, very few. So I think the proverbial handwriting is on the wall. This battle is largely over. And the notion that the Russians are taking heavy casualties, which continues to be repeated ad nauseum, is just nonsense. It's the Ukrainians that are losing vast numbers of troops. In fact, I just received a lengthy email from a friend overseas talking about Russians finding out from the Ukrainians that large numbers were happy to be captured because they'd had nothing to eat.
Yeah, that's been one of the problems that and especially now the entire garrison in Mirnograd is now going to suffer from that, because the only way they can get any kind of supplies, whether it's ammunition or food, is by some of these larger drones, which of course are also getting shot down. So it's just a matter of time before they really succumb to just the elements and hunger, I guess, for that matter. What do you think is the significance of the loss of Pokrovsk and Mirnograd militarily?
Well, militarily, you've just destroyed the heart of the logistical infrastructure that supplies and sustains whatever is left on the eastern Ukrainian front. So it's the death knell of the Ukrainian army for all intents and purposes. So I think that's why it's much more important now than ever that strike weapons, whether they come in the form of ATACMS or Storm Shadow or anything else, show up and then are launched by NATO technical advisors from somewhere west of the Dnieper River against Russia, because it's the only way to signal that there is any life left, when in reality it's a facade. There is no life left. The war is for all intents and purposes over. The Russians are just going to grind away and grind away and grind away until there's nothing left.
And the Russians have not been shy about making that very claim here. And unfortunately, it is counterbalanced by claims almost from as though the Ukraine and the European side were on the advantage and on the upside of the strength balance of power between the two. So totally disconnected from reality what it is. But President Putin, though, one can either say either he is the one who's disconnected from reality, or he knows something the rest don't. I want to show you something he said just hours ago. So this is quite fresh. And he's going to, and just as a stage setter here, he's talking about something that one of the senior NATO officials, a general from Italy, said just a day before yesterday, I think. He said that NATO is considering preemptive action to get tougher with Russia because of what he claims, this general, our gray zone operations. And Gary, if you could put that full screen up there of the Italian general, because I want to read what he had to say. He said NATO is considering preemptive action against Russia following a string of hybrid attacks on Europe, senior official in the alliance's warned. Italian Admiral Giuseppe Cabo Dragoni, who serves as the chair of the NATO Military Committee, so not some minor official, said the alliance may need to adopt a more aggressive approach to deter Moscow from continuing its campaign of drone incursions and cyber attacks and apparently sabotage operations elsewhere in Europe. Even before I get to what Putin said about that, what is your understanding of what either Russia is doing or at least what the accusations of them are doing?
Well, I think the allegations of Russian incursions into NATO territory with so-called drones that were repurposed somewhere in Ukraine and then sent west, I think all of those have been debunked. My Polish sources tell me that all the claims made inside Poland were debunked. None of the nonsense that was claimed at the time happened as presented. The notion that the Russians are deliberately violating airspace over the Baltic states, that's all crap. It's nothing. It's just nonsense. You know, the real issue is as follows. What can the globalist leaders in the West who are opposed to Russia do at this point? They have no military power with which to strike. They really don't. As we've discussed before, this is a collection of boutique armies. Even if you brought them all together and piled them up against the border between Poland and Ukraine, it would still be a monstrosity. There's no unity of command, and as a result, no unity of effort. These people haven't really trained together. They can't understand each other. And logistically, it's a nightmare because they have different kinds of equipment and engines and spare parts and so forth. So what do you do? Well, you make threats, some of which are hollow and some of which are real. Yes, there are things that the NATO states can do with the help of MI6, Mossad, and the CIA to harm Russia. Are they fatal? Are they existential threats? No. But they can do damage. There's no question about that. And that's what this admiral is saying. Now, remember, Dragoni is reading from a script. You might as well have just passed these statements out to all the leadership and said, this is today's story. This is what you need to talk about. That's all there is. But having said that, the Russians have been also very clear, saying, you know, this is dangerous. You know, promising to escalate like this and then trying to carry out some of these things could lead to a larger and more dramatic response from us. I think at this point, that's about all they can say. The adult in the room is missing. And who's the adult who's in charge of NATO? His name is Donald Trump. And these people are making ridiculous statements that inevitably are his responsibility because he leads NATO. And if he really wants this nonsense to stop and he wants to put an end to the pointless slaughter of human life, he needs to step forth and stop it. The problem with threats is that, and Donald Trump confronts this, by the way, right now in Venezuela, is that if you make lots of threats, occasionally you are obliged to carry through on them. In other words, if you make threats long enough, in order to retain any measure of credibility, you have to do something. And something is a bad idea right now because Russia is armed to the teeth. It has the complete backing, you know, the Russian state has the backing of its population. Its military power is at a peak. Why would you do something stupid like this at this point? Well, you know, what else can you do but rant and rave and then hope that you can pull off a stunt like the drones that were used against the Russian bombers at an open airstrip that were left there because of the START treaty requirements? That's the sort of stupid thing that you can try. Can you try to go far forward into some area still controlled by Ukraine east of the river and launch strike weapons like the Storm Shadow or other missiles? Yeah, I suppose you can. But it's a very dangerous proposition. It needs to stop. And this is where President Trump, who talks a great game and then ultimately does nothing, needs to step up and say, you know, I'm in charge and I'm saying stop.
Well, he certainly does, because if he doesn't, as you point out, then that puts NATO in a tough situation to where if they act on that, whether in defiance of Trump or even without his knowledge, who can say? But Vladimir Putin this morning said, hey, listen, you need to understand, if you start any action with us, we're going to finish it. Now, in this clip here, he says something that's really important, a couple of things. One, he directly addresses the possibility of conflict with NATO. But the second thing is he makes a very clear distinction between a special military operation and war.
I've said that 100 times. We have no plans of fighting against Europe. But if Europe wants to fight and they start this fight, then we are ready right now. There is no doubt about this. But the only question is, if Europe starts the war, unleashes this war, because that's not Ukraine. With Ukraine, we use some surgical means. We are trying to be really careful. Because you understand why. This is not a war in the direct sense of the word. And Europe, all of a sudden, wants to start a war. And if it does start a war, then very rapidly there might be a situation where we have no one to negotiate with.
So let me ask you that, your assessment, first of all, in this claim, and many in the West believe this, and I keep running into them a lot, in that Russia has, quote, only gotten about 1% of Ukraine territory over the last, whatever it is, 18, 24 months, because that's all they can do. And Putin is seeming to say here, that's not all we can do. We're taking this slow, go slow approach, but we can bring in the big fist if we need to. Is he telling the truth?
Well, of course he's telling the truth. The problem is that he is not engaging in the bombast that Americans in particular, and to a lesser extent, Europeans have become accustomed to. What do I mean by that? Donald Trump makes outrageous, outlandish statements that are completely unsupportable, and many of them are very threatening. And that's the sort of thing that people in the West are accustomed to. You're listening to the man who is the commander-in-chief of the Russian armed forces and leading the Russian state right now. He is not the Lone Ranger. He has an inner circle. He has a National Security Council. He has a parliament. Others are also engaged in this process. He does not make statements without consulting everyone else. That's an intelligent way to do business because it forces cohesion on the state, and that's what he's got right now. He's a very cohesive state and cohesive society. All he's saying in a very matter-of-fact way, which is probably a mistake because most people won't get it, he's simply saying that we're prepared to fight. And if you want to risk war with us, we will give it to you. Now, you and I, we served in the military. You listen to someone say that, and you look at the facts on the ground, the readiness of the armed forces, and you're taking it very seriously. But people in the West don't. You know, somebody said to me the other day, Doug, no one will take the Russians seriously until they're standing on the Russian border or on the Polish border. And I said, well, that's just insane. He said, because people are fed the lies day in and day out. Everyone fails to understand something which we, you and I, and I many, many times from the very beginning talked about. This war was never about exclusively territory, which is the way we think. We're an anachronistic military force when it comes to thinking. They thought in terms of what do we need to do to destroy the Ukrainian armed forces? We got to go back to 2022 and 2023, go back to the time when Surovikin takes over. He creates what we later referred to as the Surovikin Line, which is this strategic defense structure in eastern Ukraine. He pulls out of Kherson. He simply abandons it because he understands it has no real strategic value at this point, because it doesn't serve the long-term objective, which is the total and complete destruction of the Ukrainian forces fighting against us. So moving further west is not the issue. They can do that. And I think you're going to witness some of that now. It's almost impossible for the Russians to avoid moving to Zaporizhia, seizing control of the banks of the Dnieper River. There's still an excellent bridge in Zaporizhia. It creates the opportunity for them to cross at will. So I think something like that will happen. But that's not the point, because one thing that Putin understands is the history of his own country. He understands that the people west of the Dnieper, particularly in western Ukraine, do not want to be ruled by Russians. He doesn't want to rule them either. They are a lot of trouble. That's why the joke in Moscow is, gee, let the Poles have these people. We know how well that's turned out. That was always a catastrophe. The Ukrainians hate the Poles and fight with the Poles just as they've hated and fought with Russians. The point is, the war militarily is a dead end. In other words, it's even wrong at this point to talk about Ukraine on life support. It really isn't. The Ukrainian criminal structure, which is corrupt to the bone, that's on life support. They want desperately to get more cash fed to them so they can redistribute it within the criminal networks that currently run the country. And as you and I have talked before, stuff as much cash as they can into the planes on the runways, ready to take off when they decide to finally leave the country. The people in Western Europe have been lied to from the beginning about all of this and about the aims and purposes of Russia. It's beginning to sink in. Things in Germany are finally beginning to fall apart. Merz is reporting to his masters in New York City in the banking system and London, City of London banks. These are the people that have been driving all of this. You know, you want to listen to someone who can pile the lies on almost better than anybody else that I've listened to about Russia? Listen to this man, Bill Browder. He's a perfect example of what's operating behind the scenes. Everything is designed to destroy, harm, strip away Russia. And having failed, you know, to make that strategy work, they just keep on lying to keep this thing going as long as possible on the assumption that somehow or another that will retain control of Europe and will weaken Russia. It's all nonsense. It needs to go away. But who's going to stand up and tell the truth? I mean, when you have Hodges and Petraeus and Keane and these other people coming forward telling you, oh, we're just around the corner from another victory, you know, give us another $100 billion and everything will be just fine. It was just insanity. And it's costing millions of people their lives and future.
It's interesting you say who's going to tell the truth. As it turns out, also, Vladimir Putin is on that very point as well. So one of the other things you said in that same interview today, just hours ago, given the fact that Witkoff is in town to see him, they could literally be meeting right now. And he took some time to say, you know, we're willing to talk to Witkoff. We're interested in having negotiated a settlement with Trump. We think that we can have, come to an agreement with him. He said, but Ukraine and Europe are working counter to that to try and sabotage Witkoff.
Even when they are trying allegedly to introduce some changes, some adjustments to the President Trump's proposal, all these changes have only one goal in mind. They are aimed at blocking and putting to a halt this peace process. They are trying to make demands that are unacceptable for Russia, and they understand this, and then later they would try to blame Russia, accuse Russia of stopping this peace process. This is their objectives, and we can clearly see that. That's why, well, if they want to go back to the reality, considering the reality on the ground, then they are welcome.
So, yeah, if they want to deal with reality, we're all about that. But if they want to keep with the fiction, we'll just keep going on the ground. But, I mean, what do you make of that charge that the Europe and Ukraine are trying to sabotage Trump's 28-point peace plan to put poison pills in that they know Russia won't accept?
Well, the peace plan is no peace plan. It's got lots of poison pills in it anyway, so I think that's dead on arrival. Let's understand what Kushner and Witkoff are about. They're trying to salvage something for President Trump. President Trump wants to be able to declare a victory for President Trump. This has nothing to do with Ukraine as far as he's concerned. He could care less. He's already abdicated his responsibility for leadership in Europe and NATO. So apparently he doesn't have the authority that he needs from his backers in New York City and the City of London to move forward to really do anything. So what is he doing? He sent Kushner and Witkoff to go over there and say, look, Mr. Putin, we don't really disagree with you. What we really want is some sort of bone that you can throw Trump so that Trump can come out publicly and say, look, I've done everything I can, and this is the road to peace, and I've negotiated this with President Putin. He's on board. Now it's up to everybody else. And as he said a few days ago, if they're not going to accept this, then as far as he's concerned, Ukraine can fight out its little heart. You know, this is nonsense. None of this is substantive. The Russians have laid out routinely the minimal conditions for the acceptance of any peace agreement. They have never changed. So what do Witkoff and Kushner think they're going to get? In other words, the baby is ugly. The baby's not going to become beautiful. It's ugly. It's in the cradle. Some would like to strangle it. Trump wants to rescue it. But it's not going to happen. So it doesn't make any difference what Kushner and Witkoff do. And believe me, I'm sure that President Putin and his inner circle understand this. And if they can throw a bone to Donald Trump, give him something that he can point to that says, I created this. I'm the heroic figure that brought peace, tranquility, and good fortune to Ukraine. They'll do it because they want this damn thing over as well. Not because they're losing, not because they can't win. That's all nonsense. Now, let's move to the European side. Merz is on very thin ice. Look at events in Berlin. Look at the people in the streets. Look at the strength that the people on the right, the nationalist right in Germany, are achieving. They're not a bunch of crazies. They're not Nazis or any of this other crap that the globalists, you know, promote. They're simply German nationalists who said enough's enough. And look at their platform and what's in their platform. Their platform says, we want a restoration of good relations with Russia. We want to go back to doing business with the Russians. The majority of Germans will support that. They know that. Merz knows it. This is the final hour for Merz, for Macron, for Starmer and the others. They have to come up with something that keeps the war going. If they can't, and God forbid, peace should arrive on the battlefield because Zelensky suddenly leaves the country or he and his friends are accidentally blown up. Who knows? Whatever happens, that's the end of them. They lose everything, whatever little bit of credibility they may still have. And Macron and Merz are always, they're all hovering down there around 30% approval ratings. Starmer is probably lower. It's over for them. What do you do when you can't survive any longer? You create the illusion of some sort of crisis and threat that rescues you from total destruction. That's what these people are all about.
Well, and as it turns out, Mark Rutte apparently read your memo, or else you've read his memo. I don't know which way it is, because this morning he provided a little bit more complete justification for what you said, because here he's talking about, okay, well, however this thing ends, but what we really have is that Russia is going to be this big monster and scary thing, along with China, North Korea, and Iran. This whole back to this almost like axis of evil kind of thing. He's already laying that foundation. Watch this.
As we work for peace, we cannot lose sight of Russia's increasingly brutal attacks against Ukraine. Russia is systematically targeting civilian infrastructure, depriving Ukrainians of heat and light at the start of winter. Russia is not alone in this war, as China continues to be its decisive enabler, and Iran and North Korea also provide support. Since the earliest days of Russia's full-scale invasion, allies have shown unwavering commitment to Ukraine. In recent months, European and Canadian allies have provided billions of dollars of essential U.S. equipment to Ukraine through Pearl. This support is an important part of our ongoing efforts to ensure Ukraine has what it needs to defend today and deter future aggression.
You know, it's ironic. He mentioned there, and he was castigating the Russians. He said they've been systematically destroying the energy infrastructure. It was interesting because yesterday, Vladimir Putin not only didn't dispute that, he went into some detail about why they're doing it and how that's having working toward their military objectives on the ground. So he's not saying anything's wrong with that. But then this other thing here that, like, okay, there's peace coming, but man, we got to be ready afterwards. What do you make of the reality behind that?
Well, he said he didn't say energy infrastructure, not in that clip that you and I listened to. He said civilian infrastructure, you know. Look, the Russians have been very precise in their application of military power from the beginning of this operation. And I say that because it's very difficult. We talk all the time about precision strike and minimizing collateral damage. You're always going to have collateral damage, no matter how precise you are. But the Russians have actually done an exceptionally good job of minimizing civilian losses. We keep talking about it in the hopes that that will further diminish Russia, harm Russia's reputation, and strike fear into the hearts of Europeans. It's nonsense. But what I want to stop and get people to think about is, who in the hell is Rutte? Where does he come from? I don't wish to be too delicate in this sense, but he's from the Netherlands. How many people live in the Netherlands? Well, if I were running the show, I would say, how many forces can the Dutch put into the field? How many forces can the Norwegians put in the field? Remember Stoltenberg from Norway, making all these utterly ridiculous and stupid remarks, 90% of which were lies. The same thing with Rutte. You know, anybody who is a real leader in the West would turn to these people and say, shut up and sit down. We, the United States, Washington, have no interest whatsoever in continuing this destructive and pointless war with Russia. So we're not interested in what you have to say any longer. You know, the Germans understood this for years. The Russians have always understood it. At some point, you need to say, put up or shut up. During World War II, when we had 63 divisions in France, the British, including the Canadians, had 19. And the thing that no one on the Soviet side could never understand was why Eisenhower paid any attention whatsoever to what Montgomery and Churchill had to say. They had no skin in the game compared with us. 63 divisions versus 19. Well, you have a similar situation today in Europe. What is your military power? How many forces have you got? The answer to those things is not much, if anything, worthy of attention. So someone needs to tell these people, shut up, sit down, here's the answer. That is what President Trump should do. But he's not doing it. He's not doing it. Now, we can speculate on his donors, the people that really control him, and I think that Witkoff and Kushner are very representative of those donors and their desire to keep this war going with Russia. But they're not legally, legitimately in charge. Hell, they don't even hold appointments in the administration. They're not part of the State Department. And if Trump and Rubio can't come to an agreement, then he should fire Rubio and put somebody else over there that understands what the hell's at stake. It is our relationship with Russia that counts. Our relationship. The Germans understand their relationship counts. Germany, as soon as this nonsense finally ends, and I don't think it's going to last too much longer, the Germans are going to move out of NATO. They're going to leave the EU. That's where we're headed. What happens when the Germans leave NATO and the EU? Quick guess, 2-second answer, nothing. It's finished. It's over. It's irrelevant. Okay? That's where we're headed. Donald Trump can either help manage this and control it and drive it in a positive direction, or he can do what he's doing right now. Worry about the optical illusion that he wants to create. Send Witkoff and Kushner over there to help him create good optics for him. His optics don't matter. Here's a big secret that Donald Trump needs to figure out. No one in the United States gives a damn. We're not interested in what these people are doing. Most people on the streets of Kansas City or Seattle, Washington, don't even know this thing called NATO. If you tell them we've got troops over there, they'll say, really, where? Where's that? We haven't even talked about Ukraine. Ask people about Ukraine. And what are they going to say? I don't know. Well, I don't know. Maybe we need to be there. I mean, we are a planet unto ourselves. President Trump knows that. He needs to act on it. He needs to put an end to all of this nonsense. Forget the optical illusions.
Why do you suppose that might be? I mean, if you could just speculate a little bit, is it that he himself is just not willing to buck up? Because in other things, he doesn't hesitate to take really controversial statements and not care about what people think. Is it somehow that he's concerned, well, I don't know, with handlers, as you call it, or is it because he has surrounded himself only with yes men who won't tell him that that's what he should do? I mean, what do you think about that?
Well, I think all of the above, but like most presidents, and there are very, very few exceptions in our history, he's comfortable on the domestic scene, even though he engages his mouth before his brain is fully engaged. He does understand the domestic environment. He may not understand just how hard things are on the average American right now. I don't think he does. And I think people are pumping sunshine into an orifice for him to make him feel good about the economy, because it's not good. And the financial system is very fragile. But he's more comfortable talking about those things. He knows right from wrong. He's willing to address it now. Is he doing anything about it? That's another matter. I mean, how many people have we arrested up in Chicago that were responsible for trying to obstruct ICE, that were directly challenging federal authority in an area where the federal law is clear and unambiguous? None. So he really hasn't acted decisively there, and that's unfortunate. But he does understand it. But when you move beyond the borders of the United States, especially into Europe, I don't think he does. And I think he sees foreign policy the way many presidents do. It offers one of two possibilities. One is to make yourself look good, grand, and powerful. Or two, to have your rear end handed to you. Okay. Vietnam handed the rear end to LBJ. And even Nixon, who ultimately extricates us, takes too long to do it and is destroyed as a result on the way out. So the lesson for most presidents ought to be, if you don't have to involve us overseas, don't do it. He hasn't learned that lesson.
Yeah, that's one of the ironies here, because he got into office on that premise, because people did get that, especially in the Obama's Iraq stuff and Afghanistan and all these years that we just wasted there, et cetera. He tapped into that. Did he forget that?
I don't think he forgot it. I just don't know that he really believed it to begin with. I think his instincts told him exactly what you just said. But, surround yourself with the kinds of people who are there right now. And it's very seductive to believe that somehow or another you can make something good out of something bad. You know, look, he waited and waited and waited to get us out of Afghanistan. I know that President Trump in July of 2017 thought we should get completely out of Afghanistan. He was right. What did he do? He didn't. Because he was too easily seduced by the promise of success on the one hand, and on the other, he didn't feel comfortable taking that position and standing his ground, because he really didn't know much about it. What do you do when someone doesn't know much about the subject? You know, Lyndon Johnson in the basement of the White House had a replica of Khe Sanh created, showing where all the defending Marine forces were and where all the North Vietnamese were. He was trying to sort through it, understand it, manage it. How? He didn't know what he was looking at. It could have been, under the Christmas tree, as far as LBJ was concerned. He didn't know anything about that. So part of the problem is that we tend to elect presidents who are good political figures. They understand how to cultivate the public. They understand how to say the right things. They ultimately understand how to get elected. But when it comes to governing, that's a different matter. Sometimes they're okay on the domestic side. Many times they're not. But when it comes to foreign and defense policy and the economy, they fail miserably.
And I wonder if I could just kind of tap into something you said here, because a lot of our viewers may not know, some may, but when you talk about how President Trump wanted to get out of Afghanistan earlier, it's not academic or something that you read, but something that you live, because when you worked with the first Trump administration, you actually helped craft an actual plan to get us out of Ukraine. I'm sorry, out of Afghanistan.
If I can interrupt briefly, though, sure. The reason I know about July 2017, and you could bring on Steve Bannon, because it was Steve Bannon in the West Wing of the White House that told me that point blank. And he said at the end of the day, there were only two people in that whole room, because you had something like 12 people, many of whom were four stars and others were leading political figures. But there were two people that agreed with the president. One was Steve Bannon. The other was Peter Navarro. We need to get out. And you see, I think President Trump forgets that one man with courage makes a majority. That's why we have a president. He hasn't come through for us.
And but so when confronted majority,
when he was confronted with a majority opposing him, which even include this man, Kelly, that came in to be his chief of staff, he buckled.
Well, see, and that's actually what I wanted you to quantify for us, because you were brought into the administration late to craft a plan that would have got us out before Trump left office. He wouldn't have originally pushed it off until May, I think, of 2021, but would have had it before he left office. And you had president signed an order. But what happened to make that unhappen?
Well, when he ran into opposition from the Hill, from the Senate, the House, as well as from the Joint Chiefs, especially Milley, his own temporary Secretary of Defense, and at the time, the Chief of Staff to the Secretary, the Acting Secretary of Defense, was Kash Patel. They all said, "Oh, no, Mr. President, we can't just leave like that. No, we can't do that." And, of course, everyone that I spoke to, and these were people that, like you, had served over in Afghanistan more than one tour. They were knowledgeable, and they said, if you're going to go, this is a great time to go. Let's get out in the winter. And I went through them, and I said, well, we're going to drive some things out. He said, well, you may or may not be able to drive everything out, but you can still fly out, and you can still get out. And there are ways to do it. And so I sat down with people. Now, the ways to do it, that part went in the trash can because nobody in the White House was really interested in that. What they were interested in was ordering us out. They did that. The executive order was drafted. It was signed by President Trump, and people were hanging out of the windows of the executive office building cheering when the order was sent over to the White House for signature. So could he have done that? Yeah, I think he could have done that. Would that have meant that people in the Senate and the House might have tried to pass legislation blocking him? Maybe. Remember, you don't have very many brave people in Washington. People don't like to do things for which they can be held personally accountable. So given the opportunity to actually take a decisive stand, most will say, no thanks. Let the president go. And if the president's successful, they'll all cheer. And if he's not successful, then they'll hang him politically as quickly as possible.
And it's just so ironic and perverse that all the things that you had set up and the plans that you had and all of the fears that people were opposing that by saying all these bad things would happen. The bad things didn't happen after we left. It was just crickets to this day. And yet we would have saved a lot of American lives who ended up being killed because of the chaos that followed in the way it was handled under the Biden administration, which was even worse than what Trump had done. But that's just an example of exactly what you're talking about, the absence of courage and principled decision do the right thing.
Remember, keep in mind that the purpose of going into Afghanistan was always to eliminate bin Laden and 300 or 400 of his closest friends. And that was made very clear to Tommy Franks, and that General Tommy Franks made that clear to his subordinates. That's what we're going in to do. That's it. Why didn't that happen? Well, you've got to go back and you've got to look at Paul Wolfowitz, who is really running the show in the Pentagon. You've got to go back to Scooter Libby working with Cheney and Wolfowitz to persuade people that we needed to stay in Afghanistan. And so by the time you get troops and forces, very few of them, but you still got them on the ground in Afghanistan, the focus shifted away from what do we do to eliminate bin Laden, who now is sitting in Pakistan with his little crowd. And it became, we've got to focus on Afghanistan. And there were some people, and I knew them, some of them were classmates of mine, who raised their hands and said, you know, we really don't want to do that. We're going to end up in a war in Afghanistan against the Afghan people. We didn't come here for that. We need to stay out of that. We don't want to engage in what at the time the 18th Airborne Corps commander, who had never been anywhere in his life but Fort Bragg, I think his name was McNeil, he kept saying, well, we have to launch search and destroy missions inside Afghanistan. Oh, my God. To do what? And people said, that'll just enrage the population. This will become a nightmare. But that was very convenient at the time for the political leadership in Washington. It had gotten to W and convinced him, well, this is a sideshow anyway, boss. We just need to keep the lid on there and we'll go to Iraq next. I mean, you can't make this stuff up. And in retrospect, I'm sure several historians will dissect this and you'll eventually get something reasonably close to the truth. And they'll all say, how could anyone have ever reached these conclusions?
Well, yeah. No question about it. And speaking of what historians will do looking back, one of the other things I think on this current crisis or war, conflict in Russia and Ukraine is going to be, how could the West and Ukraine continue to pretend like they could win it or even push off an eventual Russian victory when the evidence was so clear that they couldn't? And somebody who's looking back at that from the position of knowledge right now is also Vladimir Putin. This is what he said yesterday when musing about how in the world can the Ukraine and the European side keep supporting this at the cost of so much Ukrainian blood.
Did I understand correctly? Yes, that the enemy was trying to seal off Krasnoyarsk at any cost, absolutely at any cost. Yes, with absolutely no regard for losses and, in my opinion, realizing that this was no longer possible, they were still throwing in more and more units, practically to the slaughter, without any exaggeration. If we keep in mind that, well, except for the nationalist battalions, not the Nazi battalions, that the Ukrainian armed forces are essentially a worker peasant army, then they don't feel sorry for the common soldier. Well, what I just said is true. It is true, yes, the nationalist battalions are not participating, they are refusing this mission. Here, the newly conscripted, the mobilized, are carrying out this task. You can tell from them, they were recently conscripted. These people are untrained. They're simply marching toward the slaughter in the direction of Krasnoyarsk. They're dying there by the dozens and hundreds.
And by the way, Krasnoyarsk, for our viewers, that's the Russian term that they use for Pokrovsk. But he's saying that the Ukraine side is just throwing these troops just into a garbage bag, if maybe even worse than a meat grinder, while keeping their better troops, the Azov Corps, etc., out of the fray, because from what I've read from other sources, they refused to go into these places where they knew they were going to lose. But yet the Ukrainian authorities kept sending these guys into the meat grinder. What do you make of that?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, in Washington, the narrative is what counts, not the truth. The narrative is what you are rewarded for repeating. The narrative is an opportunity to enrich yourself and benefit from donors. The truth is irrelevant. And I don't think that President Putin really understands that. So many of the people that are talking, you know, I was reading about members of the Senate who were insisting that Witkoff, for instance, should be considered a traitor to the United States for actually going to Moscow to negotiate, which is an absurd statement. I mean, I'm not a fan of how this president and his makeshift cabinet works, but the notion the man's a traitor because he's trying to help negotiate some deal that'll make Trump look good doesn't make him a traitor. That's nonsense. But we have to understand there's a narrative, and that's the narrative that everybody keeps repeating, and they will repeat it until they can't, and then they'll shut up and they'll walk away and they'll try to hide from the narrative. Remember, we were always winning in Vietnam. We were winning and winning and winning and killing more and more and more, and then suddenly we weren't and we left. So you have a similar phenomenon. The other thing is, Putin is the one man in this drama who ends up coming across as a true humanitarian because he actually gives a damn about the millions of Orthodox Christian Slavs who are being murdered pointlessly in Ukraine. That's a very noble thing. I happen to agree with him. I am not pleased at all with what has happened to Ukraine. I don't see any benefit to Europe or to anyone in the world to see these deaths, or for that matter, the deaths of Russians. It doesn't help us. It doesn't make us strong or great. We don't benefit. The average American doesn't benefit. Then the final point is this. If you go back and look at the famous Battle of New Orleans that elevated Andrew Jackson as a equivalent of what we would call a National Guard general in those days to national hero status, you go and look at the place that was set up as a defense. You know, the defense was brilliantly constructed, and the British stupidly attacked in the wrong place, and they ended up attacking not in these beautiful lines that you see in Hollywood, but holding their muskets over their heads because they were up to their chins in swamp water, trying to reach the 20-foot banks behind which sat the Americans. Well, of course the Americans won at very low cost. and the British were slaughtered. And it was a dumb idea. It should never have happened that way. Nobody reconnoitered. Nobody thought it through. They went the wrong way. They moved into a swamp, and the rest is history. Well, that's kind of what you've seen happen in eastern Ukraine with the Russians. The Russians built these impregnable defenses, and now these defenses have actually moved forward, always at a very deliberate and cautious pace to ensure that the intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance platforms were in place, that all the strike weapons, artillery, rocket artillery, mortars, everything were all in place, annihilating whatever attacked them. In other words, move forward, stop, be attacked. Move forward, stop, be attacked. It's been a slaughterhouse. It was a very intelligent way to do business. But it's not what we expected, because it's not what we thought they would do, because we were convinced that the Russians wanted to overrun all of Ukraine, which was never the case. They still don't.
Well, you know, and one other thing, Doug, I don't want to miss this before we run out of time with you on this topic here. But one other thing that I think that the West has miscalculated on, which could cost really bad for Ukraine, is that this recent uptick in the physical attack on the shadow fleet. We tried economic sanctions, and they wanted to have all these economic tools to try and prevent this so-called shadow fleet from doing business with oil, et cetera. Well, when that didn't work, then allegedly Ukraine, but I'm pretty sure it was using the intelligence from the West, decided to start physically attacking civilian tankers in international waters or in Turkish waters, as the last one happened to do that. But now then Russia is saying, you know what, there's a response to that. And Putin said, and one of the other things that he claimed was, it could cost you Odessa.
Is he going to talk about Odessa now?
Yeah, Gary, if you can put that last soundbite up there. Well, okay, sorry. This is not the soundbite that I was looking for. This is what he was talking about. He said Vladimir Putin, this is in today's news, just hours ago, pointed out that as a response to all of these attacks on their civilian fleet and tankers, Russia may well attack ships that call at Ukraine ports. And the head of state also said, but there is another answer for this: to cut off Ukraine from access to the sea, and then they will simply have nowhere to carry out their pirate attacks. And many have been saying in previous days to this, specifically, that it's time to take Odessa. What do you make of this this risk?
Well, this is a good example of where your brilliant plan backfires very, very badly. Odessa, which was established in the late 1700s under Catherine the Great, was never part of this place we call Ukraine. Okay, we need to understand that. It was always a Russian city established by the Russian army at the behest of Catherine the Great. This was the plan to seize control of what is now referred to as New Russia, Novorossiya. These were the areas that had been dominated by the Ottomans, and before the Ottomans, the Golden Horde, the Tartar Khanate, and so forth. There was nothing there, basically open land, because neither the Mongols nor the Ottomans had succeeded them in control, did much to develop or cultivate anything there. So the Russians moved in and took it. Now, history lesson aside, Kharkov up in the north and Odessa down in the south were always Russian cities. They were not historically Ukrainian. And again, you've got to go back through the maps. Nobody in the United States pays attention to what the maps of the United States looked like 100 years ago. But I guarantee you that the Europeans do pay attention to maps. And if you look at the last 500-600 years, you'll find out where Ukraine really existed. And it never existed down in the south near Odessa, or that far east where Kharkov is. Now, having said that, Vladimir Putin has made virtue of necessity. You're going to attack, the defenseless tankers and freighters that are in the Black Sea. Fine. We'll take Odessa. Now, can they take Odessa? Of course. They can take that very, very quickly. There isn't much down there. In fact, they just lost some strikes in the last few days that actually killed some French officers and maybe some enlisted men that had landed there with military aircraft. They didn't intend to, but they happened to be in the same location with a large number of Ukrainian pilots. And so, bang, they ended up losing their lives. Odessa has been on the menu for a long time. This is a brilliant opportunity to take advantage of the situation and take Odessa. Making sure that Ukraine is landlocked is actually a key security objective for Russia, because most of the weapons that come into the country from the south come through that port. The other source of weapons comes in from Poland. You can probably shut down Poland more easily because you have rail links and transportation links on roads and trucks, easy to spot, easy to target, easy to eliminate. But controlling a port is a more difficult proposition. The easy way to do it is to take it from the land. I mentioned Zaporizhzhia earlier. There's nothing to stop the Russians from crossing the bridge at Zaporizhzhia, moving south and seizing control of Odessa from the land. There is not much down there to defend Odessa. And by the way, Macron has wanted to send vast numbers of French troops. That means 20 or 30,000, which is all that they could send. But he's wanted to send them down there, and the parliament in France has said, "You've lost your mind, Mr. President." No. So what he has sent down there is some French foreign legionnaires and a few Air Force assets. So there's nothing to stop the Russians from seizing control of Odessa. And frankly, from their standpoint, if I were sitting there and I were asked as a member of the general staff, I'd say we should have done it a year ago.
Well, I guess we'll see what ends up happening with that. And that could, I mean, that could literally be the coup de grace that of the whole thing that could just seal the doom of whatever is going to be left of Ukraine once it's over. Listen, though, before we let you go, though, there's one last topic that I want to get your view on, because unfortunately, while we're trying to get this war ramped down, the Trump administration seems to be taking action that's setting himself up, if you can say it that way, for starting a new war, even though he campaigned against doing that in Venezuela. And there was this claim a couple of days ago that Trump admitted, actually not didn't claim, he said that he talked to Maduro and told him that basically you have, according to reports, a week to leave. Well, there was a lot of rumors that have been floating around the last couple of days that Maduro was leaving, that he was at an airfield near the border, et cetera. Those all turned out to be true. And this morning, he was defiantly dancing out in the open before huge crowds of supporters in Caracas. And basically, you see the quote there. He said, "We do not want peace of slaves, nor do we want peace of colonies," Maduro is claimed to have said. Where is this going? What do you think is going to happen here?
Well, I think, as we mentioned earlier, if you're the leader of a great power like the United States and you make threats and then you assemble forces, you are occasionally expected by the rest of the world to carry through on your threats and use those forces. I am afraid that's where we are. I suspected from the very beginning, luminaries like Elliot Abrams, who was in previous administrations, a strong neocon Zionist and a big advocate for intervention in Venezuela, the destruction of Iran, the destruction of Russia, anything else. I think he and others have tried to persuade the president that this is a cakewalk. And you'll probably never have to use the military power that you've got anyway. They'll fold. They'll go away. Now, I've sat with some people that have lived for as long as 9 years down in Venezuela, people with military and intelligence backgrounds, and they all told me the same thing. They said, sure, there are people that don't like Maduro. There's no question about it. But they don't like the idea of the United States shoving some puppet down their throats. And they are proud of their country and its past, its history, and they will fight to defend it. I think that's where we are. It's very clear that they will fight to defend it. The question that President Trump needs to ask, I doubt he's watching us, but if he is, he should go back to the methodology of purpose, method, end state. He should ask the military and the State Department leaders that are behind this, what is the political military objective for our military power? What are we really trying to achieve with military power? And is that objective that you're going to, you know, explain in detail actually attainable? You can always come up with political military objectives that are fantasy worlds. Oh, we want to do this. Well, you know, we all want $10 million. But, you know, you're not going to whip it up with a magic wand. So what are you trying to achieve? Is that attainable? That's number one. Second, what's your methodology for attaining this? How does the military power that you've assembled result in the outcome that you've just described? And then finally, when this is over, what's the end state? What do we want things to look like, not just in Venezuela, but in the Southern Caribbean basin? What do we want to happen in neighboring countries? Because they will be affected by whatever we do. So what is the regional end state as a consequence of what you're doing? Nobody asks those questions in Washington. Nobody asked them on the way into Vietnam. The man who asked those hard questions in 1951-52 was Dwight Eisenhower. And he asked them about Korea. And the answers he received were absurd. Well, we need 850,000 men to invade Manchuria, take Beijing, and end this war. What? And Eisenhower said, I'm not going to tell the American people they need to support that. Nobody in the United States wants to send people to die in Manchuria to remove the Communist Party from power in Beijing. What, have you lost your minds? So he shut it down, and he drove an end to this thing. You know, that's what Trump needs to do. He needs to step back and say, gentlemen, you have lied to me, and you've made a fool of me. No more. You're fired. He needs to get a new team.
He certainly should do that. I fear, like you, that he may have overextended, because now that he's put his credibility on the line, because now then what do you do next? If you've sent all this force down there and you have Maduro literally dancing in the street in defiance, I mean, it's hard for me to imagine how any scenario there's some of the. Yeah, they have a little dance off. Maybe that's what they should do. They should be doing a dance off instead of a military operation. I'm not sure who would lose that.
I think Donald Trump has better moves, frankly.
Well, there you go. He certainly has more audience participation there, and I guess that's the score. But in all seriousness,
you know what the best answer is? It's always the truth. I know that sounds awful and
almost anachronistic, but man, do we love it here.
Yeah, but it really is. And Winston Churchill once said, "I've had to eat my words on more than one occasion." And I always found them a full and sufficient meal. And I think that President Trump needs to say, I've reexamined all of this. And I don't see how our military power is going to result in the kind of change that we would like to see. And so I'm withdrawing our forces. And we will turn to other ways to achieve our ends in the future. One of which will be to talk directly with this government and see what we can achieve. And in the meantime, stay tuned, because in the next week, I will have announcements about new members of my team. There will be some changes in my cabinet and my advisory staff. But to do that, he'd have to be Eisenhower. He isn't.
Well, that's a very safe bet to say there. I wonder if you could just, whether it's your sources or just your experience having to do with the administration, why do you suppose that Trump didn't take the easy wins? Because at least according to reports, there's been two separate occasions, one where Maduro said basically you can have access to all of our oil and minerals, and as long as I stay in power. And then apparently on this phone call that happened a couple of days ago, he said, well, I'll just keep the military. You can even put your favorite person in the head of the government, this opposition figure that we're supporting. And apparently Trump said no to that too. Why would he say no to ones that would be huge political wins? It's like someone must be telling him, no, use the military tool here. What do you think?
Well, yeah, there's no question about it. We can speculate on who these people are. No doubt Marco Rubio, who's been crusading for intervention in Venezuela, not just there, other places in Central America, and ultimately in Cuba for many, many years. So I'm sure that he's had a major role to play. And remember who his intellectual mentor is. That's Bill Kristol, who's a leading neoconservative and Zionist. So I don't think it's hard to figure out where the theology originates or the ideology originates. That's clear. But President Trump, should have at least followed the advice of somebody like Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton only made one really dramatic mistake militarily during his tenure, and that was in the Balkans. Remember, he was castigated because he didn't want to go into Bosnia for good reason.
He didn't want another military commitment there. Neither did his Secretary of Defense at the time, Bill Perry. They all realized we have no strategic long-term interests in the Balkans. Gosh, imagine that. We want to see peace, but that's a matter for the Europeans. We'll back them, but we're not going to become involved. Subsequently, he buckled in Kosovo in a dramatic way and was dragged into that fight. He really didn't want that fight, and it went badly quickly. It was promised initially by General Wes Clark and I think Madeleine Albright and Berger, the national security advisor, that this would end in 3 or 4 days or at most a week or 10 days, something like that. Well, that was a dumb thing to say because there was no evidence to support that. You were dealing with the Serbs. The Serbs are very tough people. 600,000 of them died fighting the Germans under occupation. Think about that. You know, this is not something that you're going to witness in Serbia. The Serbs are not going to all fall apart and bend down and beg forgiveness. So this thing ultimately ends on day 78 because you send Strobe Talbot to Moscow to negotiate a deal and promise the Russians billions of dollars. I don't know the details, but that's what ended the thing. And we bombed the living daylights out of everything that didn't move, because that's all we knew how to do at that point. And it was very clear that President Clinton said there will be no troops on the ground. I'm not going to become involved in a land war. And that was his only real mistake strategically, because there was nothing at stake for us in that environment at all. And he ended it simply by telling everyone, you can bomb as much as you want. I'm sending Talbot to Moscow and there will be no ground troops. Well, that's a pretty clear exit strategy. Was it perfect? No, it was imperfect. But he escaped the trap. President Trump hasn't figured that out yet. And he's been trapped. Trapped in Venezuela, trapped in Ukraine, trapped in the Middle East.
Well, let's hope that somehow he does what you suggested a second ago and brings out a big broom and sweeps out a lot of these guys who have given him a lot of this bad advice, because he's still got 3 full years to go here. So we need to keep that in mind, too. But in any case, this is crystal clear. You gave President Trump some great advice at the end of his first term about the Afghan war. And that turned out like you said it would. So let's hope that somehow somebody gets this video to him and maybe he'll listen to you this time, too, for the sake of the country. I hope that he does. But thanks so much for coming on today with this clarity, Drug. We always appreciate it.
Thanks, Dan.
And we appreciate you guys, too. And be sure and log into our Apple Podcast, Spotify, or Podcast Addict. A lot of people really like to get this information via podcast. Share this with your friends, because I know a lot of folks that really like the podcast route, or we're getting a bigger audience in there. Also on the written format, DanielDavisDeepDive.substack.com. You will find us sitting there too, and be sure and share that with your friends who like the written form. That's also a place we're expanding into. We've been expanding also onto Rumble. So you can find us really in all kinds of places here, because we are unintimidated and uncompromised to bring you the truth no matter what it is. And we want to make sure that we get this spread to as many folks as possible. Do us a favor, like and subscribe if you haven't, but even more so if you have, share this with somebody else on a format that they really like. Thank you very much, folks. We'll look forward to seeing you on the next episode of the Daniel Davis Deep Dive.